And this is something that you will not learn in school. This is something that if you started as a first-time entrepreneur, or even if you are a serial entrepreneur like Peter, there's one thing that is always, always will be very hard, which is when we have to decide to lay off people or terminate someone from the team. This is something that is, I think, always heartbreaking. It's always a difficult decision to make. A lot of time it will involve our mind, our heart, even our soul. But yeah, this is something that I would say inevitable, right? Like in this time, markets is difficult. Startups funding is scarce. We have to do a lot of cost efficiencies. Or even when you are doing well, right? When you are doing well, your company grow, but then you find part of your team cannot keep up with the company company's growth, right? You still need to do this.
Hey, this episode is brought to you by Slice. Slice is a creator CRM to help brands and agencies better manage their content creator relationships. Our integrated platform simplifies reporting, payments, and creator relationships for branded sponsored content. Creators, sign up for Slice and get access to brands and agencies who want to hire you for brand deals. We also give you access to your analytics so you can see which channels are growing. And we also create a media kit for you. So with one link, you can send these brands or agencies your entire overview in terms of like who you are, your analytics, your audience demographics, etc. So it's a lot easier to hire you. So go to slice.id, sign up today. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the pod. We've got a great episode with co-founder and COO of Wahyu, FNB enablement platform, Daniel Chayadi. I'm probably mispronouncing that. Sorry, buddy. So Daniel and I met through mutual investors. And so I've been aware of Wahyu for a while, but pretty much at a surface level, right? And so Daniel was great in kind of like letting us know not only what the business does, but like the origin story. And I find that origin stories of like where the business model started versus where it's at today are very interesting, because most companies don't start out what they started doing, or you know, they're not doing what they originally intended to do. And that's the case with Wahyu as well. So really great to understand that that evolution of their business, especially during the pandemic, when you're talking about food and beverage. And then I also wanted to talk to Daniel about being a COO, right? So COO is kind of a different breed. It's a different role than CEO, and how they approach that role and how his role has evolved over time, and with the whole leadership team. How has the leadership team evolved? Because they have three co-founders. Wanted to get those insights because we don't always talk. You know, we talk to a lot of CEOs on this podcast, and when I think of things, I think of it through the CEO lens. And so that, I think we had some really good information conversation around that as well. And then we end the conversation around his advice on, and I think he has some really good advice that I don't always think about. So great episode. Thanks for joining in. On to the episode. Hey, Daniel, welcome to the pod.
Hi, Jesse. Thank you for having me in your podcast.
Yeah. We've been meaning to have you on for a while.
I'm sorry. I just can only make time now.
No, it's really okay. Sorry. It's okay. Finding time is the hardest part about this podcast. So you are the co-founder and COO of Wahyu, right?
Yes,
so
true.
Please share with us, you know, very briefly, like what you guys do.
Okay, Wahyu, so Wahyu actually, Wahyu was established in 2018. So it's almost, actually it's from 2017, but then the company was only incorporated in 2018. So we are now already 5 years old. And we have been gone through a lot of change since the first business model, basically. So at least we have been in three time changes. But currently, Wahyu, basically, we mainly focusing on Wahyu Kitchen Partners, where we basically become the distribution network of F&B products, basically. The way we do this is that we build a network of kitchens, last mile kitchen, as the last mile point for cooking the meals before it delivered to the end consumers. And the idea of doing this kitchen network concept is that we want to help F&B entrepreneur, especially the small F&B entrepreneurs, to actually thrive in their business, making additional income through our products. So basically, they can utilize their idle kitchen assets to cook or to prepare our own meal, our private label meals, and then deliver it to the end consumers. And from that activities, basically, they will get some kind of revenue sharing from Wahyu. So we currently, Wahyu have, in our group, we have five brands right now, five F&B brands. If I can name it, Bebek Goreng Bikin Tajir, Bakso Bikin Tajir, Ayam Paduka, Senang Hati, and the last one that we just recently launched last month is Ajaib Chicken. It's a Middle Eastern fried chicken with nasi biryani kind of meals. So this is something that we are doing right now. We are helping the small F&B entrepreneurs to maximize their assets, mainly their kitchen, to make additional income with our private label brands, basically.
Got it. So it's almost like a F&B Airbnb in a weird way, right? So
yeah, or like Uber for kitchen, Uber for kitchen,
basically. Uber for kitchen. Right. So it's like I have a small business and I make, you know, fried rice, fried chicken. Right. But I don't, not many people know about me. Right. Know about my, I might not even have a brand. Right. I might just be like a local shop. Right. So then because of the apps, right, and Ghost Kitchens, basically I'm ordering from one of your brands.
Yeah.
But it's being made by this company.
Yeah, this small local.
And it's coming from, but it's coming from your brand, right? So
they, yeah.
So in terms of how the end consumer, they don't really know about this local store.
Yeah.
So they can still do their own menu. They can still have their own walk-in clients, but then kind of like on the side, they have this. This white label deliveries.
Yeah, true.
That's Got true. It. Okay, so I have many, many questions. I think the first one, before we get into that, is like you had mentioned that you had, this is kind of like your third business model iteration, right? And so I think for a lot of early entrepreneurs, they're for, you know, everyone says you don't bet on the business idea, you bet on the entrepreneurs, right? So like, what was the first thing that kind of like you kicked off? And then, you know, what were the iterations to get to the point that you're at right now?
Yeah. So I think when Peter started Wahyu in 2017, his idea was to, so he was, his background was advertising, branding and advertising. Peter's background was branding and advertising. And he was inspired by one of the convenience stores that you can find anywhere now in Indonesia, basically, where basically this convenience store are showing brands and get paid because of showing the brands in their stores, the FMCG brands in their stores. So Peter back then thinking about where can I show brands, FMCG brands, in what place that I can show FMCG brands that is everywhere in Jakarta. And basically, he saw Warteg. right? He saw Warteg. Warteg is everywhere. Warteg is Warung Tegal. I don't know if you're familiar with Warteg. It's basically a micro eateries where it's basically everywhere in Jakarta. Usually it's only like 5 people maximum can fit into the eatery site and eat there basically. So Peter saw Warteg basically, and he thinks that, oh, I can do something here in Warteg. I can make my clients' brands there and then get paid for it. At the same time, we'll share the revenue for whatever the advertising revenue coming from the brands. He will share it to the Warteg owners, right? So that's the first business idea, advertising actually. So that's why Wahyu was started with putting a lot banners everywhere. We call it Wahyu di mana-mana, or Wahyu is everywhere. We put these banners in front of the Warteg. This is the idea is to attract brands to put banners there, right? Then Peter got the first clients, which is the two or three clients, which is coffee and tea brand back then, instant coffee and bottled tea brands back then, right? The first client. But the funny thing is that when these brands wants to put advertising in Wahyu, they said 50% of the budget the budget is cash, 50% will be in forms of product. Because when they see Warteg, they think it as a point of sales rather than advertising spots, right? So they pay us with 50% cash, 50% product, right? Now, because we have these huge products there, like billions of rupiahs products in our warehouse, then we have to sell it, right, to the Warteg owner, say that, but you can buy this coffee, instant coffee, you can buy this tea bottle. And then, yeah, from this transaction, we get we convert the product into money, right? Now doing this, when Peter doing this, right, the owner asks, Peter, why you only sell coffee and tea, right? I also need cooking oil. I also need rice. I also need chicken. I also need everything they need in the Warteg. Then this is brings the idea, which comes into the next iteration, which is, oh, we it's not only advertising here, we can do also e-supplies. Meaning that we supply the Warteg owners with whatever products that they need, basically, right? So then we come into the era of e-supplies. Back then also e-supplies, to be honest, it's a hot industry. 3-4 years ago, it's a hot industry. A lot of startups are doing it, getting a lot of fundings, right? But yeah, we know, all of us know what happens now with this business model. But back then it was very hot. It was a hot industry. So we come into this business model. We onboard almost 30,000 small and medium, micro, small and medium eateries into our platform, and they're transacting with us. They're buying supplies with us. That's the second business model that we are doing. And then pandemic hits, boom. When pandemic hits, all these eateries has to close down. We have freeze on our revenue. Then we go into the end consumers. So we do have these delivery capabilities. We do have groceries and everything. So we start selling to the end consumers. But it's not long. We only do it for 1 year. We realize the competition, the market is very different with the Warteg owners. So 1 year after that, we sunset the business of the B2C, basically. So we still focusing on the B2B supplies. But now, as you can see, after so the market of funding investment is not really good, and then there are lots of failing businesses on the e-supplies because, you know, the economics doesn't make sense, the cost is too high, it's a burning money burning business. But luckily for Wahyu, we have never really boost our growth by burning money. That means we always focusing on the product market fit, right? We always focus on the product market fit. And if we feel that we haven't find the right product market fit, we don't want to grow. We don't want to burn money. this is some, I think, the decision that put Wahyu as the, at the best position right now to survive. Because when we do this e-supplies business, we know that it's not the right product market fit. We sell product because of the price, not because of the value. We provide solution to the end, to the customers, because of pricing, not because of the values, right? So that's why in 2021, end of 2021, we start thinking about new business model. What really matters for these small, micro, small and medium F&B entrepreneurs? What really matters? The fact is that they are not really okay lah. Supplies and everything is something that they can help them, but their main point pain points is not there. The main pain point is still revenue. So what we back then, what we try to think is how we can help these businesses to make more revenue, to make more income. That's why the Wahyu Kitchen Partner concept is born in 2021, late 2021. And in 2022, we focus a lot on this business. We grow the business. And by now, we can say that Wahyu has a full pivot to this Wahyu Kitchen Partner concept. But at the end of at the back of the business, we still have the supplies and infrastructure, the supply infrastructure, and all the features that we have built back then to support this Wahyu Kitchen Partner business. I'm sorry if this is too long, but you can cut everywhere.
No. This is great. So just so I can recap to make sure I've followed along, right? You started with advertising, right? Advertising, but because of the payments, you inadvertently kind of got into physical products, right? Yeah. Which then led you into the kind of grocery to the customers, to the businesses, and then because of the pandemic, you had to shift the model even more, right? And then everyone obviously needed revenue, and you had, because you had built these relationships and essentially this network of
warthogs.
You kind of had like this network distribution that you could then kind of iterate the idea even more, right?
Yeah,
so that kind of brings you to today. You have these like ghost kitchens with your brands, right?
Yeah.
So that, you know, I love that story, right? Because I think our company's kind of going through similar, you know, we're doing pure software, but we're going through similar learning curve of like, what does the customer actually want, right?
Yeah,
finding product
true.
Market fit, not
that's important,
not burning a lot of cash to just, you know, on ads, etc. So you are in F&B though, right? And so that's an entirely different animal, right? And I have friends who own just kind of like shops, right? You know, one or two shops. So I guess I will ask you, you know, this is kind of the first question that came to mind when you were telling me about this, because you have the multiple brands, right? And you are essentially contracting these little restaurants to make your food and deliver it, right? How do you ensure the quality and consistency of the product, right? Because that's, you're the one who has the end brand, but you're not the one kind of controlling the product.
Yeah. So the concept of our each of our product in our brands, 95% of the processes to make the food basically has been done in the central kitchen. So only 5% the kitchen partner have to do. Basically, it can be like just fried it, refry it, reheat, steam it, right? So it in terms of taste, consistency, usually it's always there. But the main mistakes that keep happening that we found is that we prepare an SOP, a very simple SOP for the kitchen partners to follow. But sometimes they miss some step. That's in the results of that. Usually there are missing items in the, let's say in one packaging of meal, it should have these five components. but then they miss one component, basically. So that's the main challenges that we always find from the customer feedback, from the end consumer feedback. Usually there's a missing item. It's seldom about the taste. It's seldom about the quality of the product. We try to minimize the process in the last mile kitchen, and most of the process will be done in the central kitchen. So it will be consistent, basically. That's the first one. It's a ready to cook. It's basically ready to cook meals that we deliver to the kitchen partners. We do have SOPs. And then the third one, of course, we invest a lot in the quality check, basically. So we have a team of on-ground agents who do quality check every day. Every day, one agent should check like at least 3 kitchens and create reports like scorecards from every kitchen, the way they handle hygiene, the way they handle inventory, the way they cook, the way they deliver, like how the look and feel, right? This is something that we assess, and we have this like 7 to 10 agents every day visiting the kitchens. Right now, we have 330 kitchens in Jakarta only. In Jakarta only, 330 kitchens. So can you imagine if one guy can visit 3, meaning that in 1 month maximum, they can visit 90, but sometimes we ask them to visit twice a month. So they can only visit like 40 to 50 kitchens per month. So we need like 7 people to do this visits and create scorecards. And if the scorecards is bad, the score is bad for this kitchen, we give them warning. First warning, I give you another 2 weeks to improve. Second visit, not improve. Second warning. After the third warning, we close them down. Because they cannot be our partner anymore. We change the partner. So that's how we are very serious about quality.
That makes sense. Yeah, you're constantly eating your own product. That's kind of the feedback that I've gotten. But that's a lot, right? So interesting. One, just quickly, what does SOP mean?
Standard operating procedure.
Okay, just clarifying for everyone. And then two is, so you are not, I had it wrong in my head, right? I was assuming your team would come up with a recipe, right? And then you would ship them the ingredients and say, here, follow the recipe. But no, you have a central kitchen and you're basically making the meals and then they just have to like heat it up, essentially.
Okay.
So was that the original plan or did you?
That's the first time we did this. We always do it like this, because we learn from other markets, like US market, who have the similar model with us, and they do like just like what you said, give the recipe to the partners.
Yeah.
The quality is pretty bad. If you see the ratings in DoorDash and everything, they usually have rating below 4, like 3.5, 3.3. It's really bad. While us, we always keep maintaining a rating above 4.5.
Okay. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, essentially, because, you know, with food, the taste and the consistency is the biggest problem, in my opinion, when visiting restaurants. I mean, globally, but I feel like there's an acute problem in Indonesia where it's very common for a restaurant to launch, food is good, and then 6 months later, things just taste a little bit different for a lot of the restaurant. And you said you have 330 restaurants or locations in Jakarta. Are you only in Jakarta or are you in other cities or expanding?
We mainly still focus in Jakarta. We do some small operations in Semarang, Solo, and Bali, and Bandung. Yeah, but it's a small operation. This is something that we are still learning, doing pilots, things like that. But we are expanding soon. And again, the way we expand, we are looking for partners In, let's say, in Surabaya, in Pontianak, Medan, these tier two cities, we are looking partners to help us in distributions, in managing the partners, basically managing partners from onboarding, training, quality control. So these partners basically will help us to scale in these areas. And we still responsible in product development, marketing, branding. This is something that we still on us, and hopefully with the right partner, they can also maintain the high standard of quality like us, do a lot a good distributions to their partners basically. So yeah, we are looking for partners in these cities.
All right, yeah, growth is always difficult, and especially there's a lot of when you're dealing with physical businesses. There's just a different type of growth. We just had Fresh Factory on the podcast, so they're kind of going through some similar things. So the COO title can be controversial, at least on the people that I follow on Twitter. There is a camp that thinks you don't need one as a 10-20 person startup. You don't need that role. It's just kind of like a glorified title. And there are other people who truly believe that you do need it. And it kind of separates the roles at an early stage as your company grows. I typically believe that you do need it. I think that, maybe in the beginning, you don't technically need it, but I think it's good for the co-founders to kind of like fill out those roles, grow into those roles. So Daniel, being a COO, right? And he was a former CEO, right? So he has this really good perspective in terms of like, how you divide it, how you should think about it, right? Because every management senior leadership team is going to be different. The entrepreneurs are going to have different strengths and weaknesses, right? So it's hard to put a very specific roles and responsibility from company to company in terms of CEO and COO, right? But I think Daniel explains it very, very well, like how they approach it, what his role is, not only on a day-to-day, but like within the company. So I think this is great advice for any co-founder duo, and especially for the person who might be assuming that COO role. I want to talk a little bit about your role and your relationship with Peter. Right. So you had mentioned that Peter had a branding advertising background before he started this. Right. And yeah. Your background, I saw you worked at Google. Right.
So yeah.
You two were both, not slinging burgers, BACMI. Right. This is, and now you guys are, FMB entrepreneurs. Right. So how did you guys meet, first of all?
Mm.
Right? And what made you want to like kind of do this? Because I mean, because the original idea was advertising, you thought, yeah, I could do this, or just, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Peter is actually a serial entrepreneur. He has been an entrepreneur since 17 years old. So it's been more than 20 years of experience of entrepreneur for Peter. While for me, I graduated as a computer science graduate. And then after university, basically, I worked at a management consulting company for 7 years. And then after that, then I moved to Google and spent 3.5 years in Google. My role was a sales team in Google, selling advertising also, yes, to clients. Like mainly my clients back then was in e-commerce and ride-hailing vertical. So it was exciting times back then. But then in 2018, I decided to resign from Google and start my own company. Back then, it was not Wahyu, basically. It's another company that I found with my partner, which is currently the CTO of Wahyu also. So when I built my company, me and Peter was... I would say being matched by someone up there in a events, accelerator programs, things like that, right, basically. So I got introduced to Peter in this few encounters, a few events, basically. And it's just like it happens to be we have similar shareholders, similar people in the cap tables of the both companies, right? And these guys saw that each of our business have its lack, have its own strength and also a weakness, right? And somehow it complements each other. That's why basically in 2019 we got merged mainly because that my company back then is have a strength of product and tech people, but Wahyu has a very strong how do you say a story, a business model back then, right, which really needs my team's help basically to put Wahyu to the next level. That's why we got merged in 2019 basically. So that's the story of how me and Peter knows each other. So is that the question? Or
yeah, no, any... that's interesting because I was unaware of that, right? And so like, there are, you basically merged, right? And so it was not like you both came up with this idea over coffee one day. It was like you're working on similar things. No, I think that's, you know, a lot of people think of the first version, but this is another version of the story that, you know, companies go through. So
yeah,
one thing that I'm curious about from you, right? Because again, you're talking about merging and now you've gone from like the CEO position to a COO role, right? And I think CEO roles in startups can be a little bit controversial, right? There are some people who are like, you don't need them. Some people, like a lot of them have them, we have them, right? How do you define, you know, how did you define this role? Like what you are focused on versus what the CEO and Peter is focused on?
Okay. So I think every startup will have its own way of dividing the tasks between, let's say, CEO and COO. Usually, CTO will be very clear. They are responsible on technology, sometimes also responsible on product, right? But luckily, you know, our CTO also very good in business. So he is also an entrepreneur. He has his own business. So he very good at the technology, but at the same time have a very good business acumen. But for me and Peter, when we talk about our roles, I think we look into each other's strength, right? For me, I really enjoy working with numbers. I really enjoy working with processes. While Peter is very strong at people. He is very strong at branding, right? So this is the way he's very strong at dealing with people also, dealing with getting other people to become very comfortable with him, right? This is something that I don't have. I don't really strong at lah. I'm more like, the back end guy, lah, basically. Peter more like the front end guy. So that's why we split the tasks basically. So Peter will be responsible as the face of the company. He will be responsible as the how the people looks up to him, right? Both internally and externally. He built business. He met people, exploring business opportunities, and sometimes dealing with investors. This is Peter's main job basically. But when it comes about numbers, and it comes about talking about the organization structure, the processes that have to be in place for the organization to run efficiently and effectively, then this is my job, basically. So, yeah, I think that's how we split it, back end and front end guys. So that's why any chance of media exposure, usually I will push it to Peter. Even like when you ask me, right? I why don't Twitter? But yeah, that's the way we position. But again, Peter also wants the team, especially the leadership team, to also have exposure to the to media, exposure to the industry. So then every one of us can actually push the growth of YU together, basically. The good image of YU also. And I would say I'm very happy. I think it's also because of how Peter's bring this company and lead the company. I would say we can probably say so far what you still have a quite good perception internally as well as externally.
Well,
yeah.
we're happy to have you on the pod. You are not our second
thank you,
choice.
Thank you.
But no, I think that explanation of kind of front end back end is clear. It's similar to what we're doing at our company. I'm just a lot more public facing, dealing more with the investors, and in the product side, where my partner's doing a lot more of the operations, and thankful for that because there's a lot of things a lot of details that I will get lost in. But then so. Your role has evolved, right? What is your current headcount at right now?
Currently, we have 100.
100. So
we in peak, when it was on peak, we have 250 actually.
And when you merged, how many were there?
When we merged, I think it was around 60. I think.
Okay, so
yeah, 60.
Before the merger, right, you were operating a smaller company. Then you have this, mid-sized company, and then you've grown from to 250 to 100, even in that range, right? There's still a lot of growth. There's still a lot of organizational structure that changes, right? So, I guess, how did your role change, or what was one of the bigger obstacles or kind of like lessons that you kind of learned and discovered as the company was growing like that?
This is based on my experience. Yeah, I haven't been able, I don't have experience in a much bigger company, but at least from the moment I start until now, I think in essence, the role of CEO is still the same, right? How I put things in place, people, system, processes, right? So that it can work effectively, right? But I think when we started, we don't have a leadership team. It's basically only three of us, Peter, me, and Michael, the CTO. So of course we start small. We do something very basic. Even I still spend a lot of time in the warehouse doing picking and packing myself. Sometimes I do delivery myself back then. Still have to lift heavy stuff. But at the same time, when I do that, basically I'm thinking about how to do it better, right? What kind of system that we have, we have to have in the on place so that it can run better. What kind of people? What kind of processes that have to be in place? But I think along with the growth of the company, the maturity of the company, we are able to hire very good seasoned leadership team. And my role now changed to how to make sure the leaders have the resources to make sure their department or their team works well, right? So a lot of times, currently, I think a lot of times my day to day would only meet with the leaders, one by one, or sometimes in a group, just get listening to their issues, listening to their plan, listening to their ideas, and ask them. So what kind of support do you need? Right? If they don't ask for support, then I just try to trust them to do their task, their job. I try to not do micromanage at all, but sometimes I have, if let's say revenue goes down suddenly, right? Then I'll just ask the people responsible, hey, what happens? Show me the report. What are the learning things like that, right? But most of the time, I try to not bother them. But yes, we do have regular conversations about what they want to achieve and what they need in order to achieve this their goals, basically. So yeah, I think that's how my role changed. Yeah, from doing basic stuff, simple, and thinking about what kind of improvements, to now where we just trust our leaders to do their job and try to give to provide support when they need it.
Yeah, I think unblocking and protecting your team is very very comfortable, and let them do what they do best.
Yeah.
So you've mentioned your third co-founder a couple times, right?
Yeah.
And one thing I'm curious about is when you have three co-founders, right? How do you approach the decision-making process, right? Because with an odd number, I think it changes the dynamics, right? And especially because you and him worked together before you joined forces with Peter. Right. So like, what does that, you know, executive team conversation look like? Like, how do you deal with those issues?
Yeah. Yeah. So, first of all, I think everyone has their own forte. Like I mentioned before, right? Everyone has their own strength. Usually if it's about branding and it's about marketing, I will trust Peter's decision, Peter's judgment. But if there's a really a risk, then we will highlight, there's a risk here. Maybe we should rethink about it, things like that. Right. If it's about technology, decision, and everything, we can give inputs, but we trust Michael to make decisions. So I would say 70% of decision-making, we support each other usually. But yes, there are some times that we have different way of thinking, different opinion, right? And first of all, when we identify if there's a conflict there, we do have our own groups though, three of us. We usually discuss about this in the group, but then we will say that let's not discuss it over text, let's meet. Right? That's the first principle. We cannot talk about difficult decision over WhatsApp group. It's just too many interpretations, basically. Sometimes you cannot also see the face of this person, whether we should be empathized, whether we should push more, things like that, right? So we have to meet. Even if it's on the weekend, we will just meet. Lucky for us, we live close to each other, so we can meet every time we want, right? So that's when we meet, right, basically. And I think three of us, we are at the late 30s. So I would say we are not really that emotional. Sometimes we can be emotional, but we try to understand each other, listening to each other views, right? Usually we can solve it once we meet. Like, yeah, if one guy is not really agree, then if the two guys agree, then we will support whatever decision this is that we agrees on as a forum, right? But if in the case we cannot agree, let's say, maybe just one example is when we have to lay off people, right? It's very hard, to be honest. It's very hard. I have my own view, Peter has his own view, Michael has his own view. If we cannot come into terms, we usually will involve our leaders. So we will meet with our leaders then. So we call them, everyone, and then we share the issues, or what are the different views, and then we ask the broader group to give us inputs. And again, we are very grateful that we have a very strong leadership team. Sometimes they are actually more mature compared to us. They are more stable sometimes. they have a more critical point of views, which really helps us in making the decisions. That's, I think, usually it's by the time we met with the leadership team, we will find the answer.
No, that's great, right? You know, it extends beyond the three of you, right? You're really trusting. If you've listened to any of these podcasts with any regularity, you know that I like to end the conversation around advice, you know, advice for new, early, young entrepreneurs. And Daniel, I think, went a little bit in a different direction than typically the way that I think about it, way that a lot of other guests answer the question. But I think his answers, one in particular, are very, very poignant, very important to be aware of, and not something that I or anyone really likes to think about. So I would definitely stay for the end of this episode. And yeah, thanks for listening. So one question that I like to ask is, you've clearly learned a lot of things during your time, right? You know, your changing of the business models, the evolution of your role. Is there something that you learned that you didn't even know that you needed to know once you started this company?
Yes. And this is something that you will not learn in school. This is something that if you started as a first-time entrepreneur, or even if you are a serial entrepreneur like Peter, there's one thing that is always, always will be very hard. Which is when we have to decide to lay off people or terminate someone from the team. This is something that is, I think, always heartbreaking. It's always a difficult decision to make. A lot of time it will involve our mind, our heart, even our soul. but yeah, this is something that I would say inevitable, right? Like in this time, markets is difficult. Startups funding is scarce. We have to do a lot of cost efficiencies. Or even when you are doing well, right? When you're doing well, your company grow, but then you find part of your team cannot keep up with the company's growth, right? You still need to do this, right? Because a lot of reasons. One time when it was not it was on my first company, there was basically one underperforming team member basically, and it's very hard for me to let go basically. But then one of my team member, which is quite senior, give me advice basically. Actually, if you're not letting this guy go, you are being selfish. So he told me like that, you are being selfish because you block him to have his own success somewhere else, right? So it's still a very hard decision to make, right? But this is something that all of us have to, you will face this inevitably. it's never easy, it's never a good feeling. It's always a bad feeling to do this.
Yeah, I've had to do it like here and there, but I've never had to do mass layoffs, which is the people that I've spoken to who have done that. It's not a fun experience, and I can't imagine. So that's good. Now let's end the pod on a positive note. What if, you know, if you're giving advice to a first time entrepreneur or someone who has recently started a company, like, what would you tell them?
Difficult questions, yeah. But I might share things that is not really obvious, like, yeah. I think if you are doing startups or any other business, like any kind of business, product marketing is important, hiring marketing is important, meeting with your customers is important, things like that, blah, 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 right? But there's one thing that I recently learned and experienced it myself, that is actually something that you have to know, even not only when you started a company, even if you just work at any company, right? Is how you manage your well-being, your mental health, basically. This is something that, again, no school teaching us about mental health, how you manage your well-being, how you deal with stress, how you deal with pressure, how to feel your feelings, things like that. Right? It's not something that any school teaches us. A lot of times also, not many people are telling us to be aware of that, but it's something that I think real and how we can actually aware that this is something that we need to know, or we can learn the skills to actually manage our mental health, right? And by doing this, the result is that we can be happier in whatever we are doing. So when you are happier in whatever you're doing, it actually will energize you more to do hard things, to do more difficult things. So this is, I think, something that I want to share to the whether you are in a career or doing something, building something new, is that please be aware with your own mental health. Sometimes you will forget it because you are too excited with what you are doing, and then you drown in your work, and you forget about your mental health until you break down. That's something that I want to share maybe.
No, I think that's great. I think that it's great that you say that publicly. You know, for me, you know, coming from America, it's, you know, a lot of people talk about mental health freely, openly, no judgment. I think it's a little bit different in Indonesia. And I think for men, even it's a little bit different, right? So I totally agree with you, because entrepreneurship is, it's fucking hard, man. You know, and, you know, not just layoffs, but like every day, right? And it is taxing, and it can be lonely. And so, yeah, I definitely think that's very, very sage advice to be aware of your mental health, your triggers, how to deal with it, and so that you're balanced. Because, you know, if you at the top can't handle it, then you can't expect everyone else to.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
Daniel, appreciate the time and the knowledge. It was great having you.
Thank you very, very much, JC, for having me here. Really enjoyed the talks here.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Side Door Podcast. I appreciate any likes and ratings that you will give us. I really appreciate it if you share this with a friend. You know, we always appreciate a larger audience to hear the stories of these entrepreneurs in Indonesia. If you go to sidedoor.xyz, that's going to take you to our Spotify playlist, so you can hear all of the episodes there. You can subscribe there. And, you know, here we're doing a little bit more video. So if you go to sidedoor.video, that's going to take you to our YouTube channel. So you can subscribe there. You can watch the episodes there. You can kind of track where my funky eyes are going and, you know, my weird faces that I make when people are speaking. But, you know, I'm pretty excited about this. We've got a lot more cool guests coming on. So, you know, appreciate any help that you can give me to spread the word of this podcast. If you have any suggestions for the pod or, you know, potential guests, hit me up on Twitter @Jesse Bowman. Until next time, stay curious.